Welcome to week 12 of Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. It's a real pleasure for us today to have Stian Hochklub with us today. He is a PhD student at Wesley University of Toronto. I've had a chance to cross paths, I think, on a couple of occasions now. One was at the Open Education Conference in Vancouver, and that was a couple of years ago. Most recently at the Learning and Knowledge Analytics Conference in Banff. And then this past week when we had Zaid, or 2 weeks ago now, when he did his presentation on openness in education, and he mentioned Stian as one of his heroes of the open education movement, and he's involved with the peer-to-peer university, and I imagine he'll probably reference that as he's going through his presentation as well. And it kind of dawned on us that, well, yeah, that's odd. Why didn't we invite him? And so we did manage to extend an invitation to Stian last minute to come in, and he was kind enough to accept that invitation. And from previous conversations with him, I'm sure this won't be any different, and you'll find it to be a very satisfying intellectual experience. So on that note, Stian, over to you.
Well, thanks a lot. It's a real honor to be here. Yes, Zaid is absolutely one of my heroes as well, Chris. Real honor to be invited to talk at this this meeting, and this is definitely a very kind of an emergent talk. This is something that I'm really just grappling with right as we speak. It's not kind of the conclusion of years of research that I'm bringing to you. And there might be a lot of people in this class that actually know more about many of these issues than I do. But, you know, that's what it's all about. It's peer learning. It's sharing things before they're, you know, perfectly kind of baked and polished. And, yeah, we put ourselves out there. And hopefully that will generate some fruitful discussions and ideas. So I've been thinking a lot about ways that people think at all kinds of different levels. And related to learning, related to research, related to grappling with ideas. And so, you know, oftentimes when we're struggling with something, we'll pull out some paper and we'll start jotting down some notes. And oftentimes we don't know quite where we're going. We just start putting something down on paper. You know, here there should be a slide from Tony Buzan's brainstorming and mind mapping. He kind of came up with that. So there's more structured ways of writing down your ideas and, you know, drawing connections and ideas, that putting those ideas down on paper really helps you realize all the stuff that you know, helps you draw connections and really propels your thinking forwards. And you know, this is something that people have been doing for hundreds of years. I mean, one of the new things is that more and more people have this incredible amounts of information in their lives. And this is an example from myself. I've got a Kindle, and I try to do most of my academic reading on it now because it's very easy to do highlights and to copy text. So I wrote a little script that takes all the highlights from my Kindle file and imports them into DevonThink, so I can go through them very quickly. I can tag them and stuff like that, which is wonderful. But suddenly, you know, having owned a Kindle for 2-3 months, I have more than 900 clippings from different academic articles, and so I start thinking, are there ways in which I can kind of organize this information better, and what kind of systems can help me think, help me understand, help me see connections between this information. And I often think about qualitative research and software made for qualitative research, which I think is, you know, a similar thing. You have all this raw material. It might be interview transcripts, for example, or participant observation. And you're trying to make sense of it, so you go through and you also oftentimes are operating with grounded theory, so you don't know prematurely what your categories and questions will be, but you start kind of going through the material, start tagging, start looking, and things emerge, right? And you want a software that really allows that to happen. So there's actually, here's another piece of interesting software. It's called Tinderbox. And it's a really fascinating piece of software, very complex. You can do pretty much anything, which is something that puts a lot of people off it. It seems to be a bit of a learning curve, but it has very, very strong kind of facility for expressing information visually, spatially, semantically. You can have, you know, outlines and containers, and you can even have these scripts that do things with information. And so some people just swear by it and absolutely love it. And the guy who wrote this program actually wrote a book about the program and taking notes as kind of a philosophical thing. And Mark Bernstein, it's a really fascinating kind of thing. So people are doing all kinds of great. So Leah, I'm going to post links to all of these things in my blog later today. I didn't have time to do it before the presentation, but I'll have links to all of these and all the articles I cite and all that. So here's some other great examples of what people have been doing with Tinderbox. All of this is on their website. So, you know, there's a few different things going on here. And one of the things is externalization, which is a fancy word for saying, you know, take it out of your brain and put it on a piece of paper or on a computer screen. And it's a very powerful concept because if we keep ideas in our head, you know, we could go around thinking about stuff forever, and we just, you know, we can't keep that many thoughts in our head at the same time. It's really hard to kind of get anywhere, and a lot of people feel that they have to just stop and write things down, right? When we write things down, first of all, we have to express them. We have to find specific words. Maybe we play around with words. Then oftentimes, you know, if we're writing on a piece of paper, even though we're not planning to do any elaborate visualization, we might randomly put them different places on the paper. And then you have all this this idea of, you know, this idea of hierarchy. So you'll say, okay, well, here's these four different ideas, but they're all of this category. So maybe I can lump them over here. And, you know, you kind of might be playing around with that. Maybe you say, well, actually these contain over here. But I think this idea of hierarchy is actually really crucial because, as I said, we can only keep so many things in our heads at the same time. And if we have 100 different thoughts and they're all at the same level, it's completely meaningless to us. But if we can group them, and then the other important thing that putting things on paper does is that it kind of lets you forget about part of your thoughts because you can be safe in knowing that it's on paper. You don't have to worry about it disappearing, and so you can kind of put it aside for a little while and really focus your attention on a small subset of the ideas, and that's the only way that you can really get further in your thinking. And in Tinderbox, they call this yanking. When you go to a certain point of your outline and you kind of make that the top node. So for a while, you forget everything else and you just really focus on that part of the hierarchy. And then in the safe conviction that all the other ideas are there still, right? And to me, it's funny because it reminds me of getting things done. One of the things that the author of that book says is that people are so stressed out because they don't write down everything that they have to do. And so they keep thinking about it at times when they can't do anything productive about it. And so just by putting things down, you actually help yourself. And similarly to software, I mean, if you have these modern software packages with hundreds of thousands of lines of code, I mean, nobody can keep that in mind at the same time. So what you try to do is to encapsulate it and say, okay, here's an object. And it's very well defined, and we know what it does, and we've tested it, and it does what it's supposed to do. We put this thing in, we get this thing out, and once that thing is really stable enough, we can kind of forget about it, and we can move on to other things. And so you compartmentalize different parts of the thinking process. So anyway, that was kind of an introduction to, I think, kind of an important aspect of how we think. Now, this is actually from a workshop that the Peer-to-Peer University did, and it was run by Alan Gunn, or Gunner, who some of you might have known, and he does this really interesting workshop methodology where he starts out by saying, you know, we don't have an agenda for this meeting. Can you brainstorm and can you write down as many ideas as you can for stuff that you would like to achieve during the next 2 or 3 days? One idea per sticky note, and write more than a word and less than a paragraph, right? So people just generate these sticky notes like crazy. And then, we have this big wall and we say, just put it up somewhere. And once we have all those ideas, then we start everyone collaboratively to group them. Just whenever you find two sticky notes that look similar, try to put them next to each other. And everyone's walking around, it's a nice really physicality of being up and about moving, right? Typically at conferences, you sit down way too much. So, after even just 10 minutes with a bunch of people working at the same time, you have these clusters that converge fairly easily. And then you can name them. And suddenly, you say, well, now we have the schedule for these 3 days. And we have a bunch of different sessions now. And they're all kind of sorted out, and people feel like all of their ideas got captured somehow, so they're not really walking around for 2 or 3 days stressed out about, whether their idea will be lost or not. And they can really focus their attention on the one topic that their workshop is discussing. And once they go into maybe a smaller group to discuss a subtopic, they can take all those sticky notes with them, and they can look at all the ideas more in detail. Slide lost again. Okay, by the way, I'm going to give you the link to the slide share. So if anyone wants to follow along there, you can do that. And I'll have to follow along myself as well to see what didn't make it. Let's see. So basically, there's this cycle of divergence and convergence. I mean, divergence is when you just try to come up with as much different things, as much different ideas as possible. You're generating a huge amount of useful, potentially useful ideas, right? And you really stop yourself from being too critical, and you try to just get stuff out there. But then you step back and you say, okay, well, try to organize this. Let's try to see what are the main topics, what are the kind of groupings, and what of this do we really want to work on, and what do we not want to work on. And once you have those groupings, you can go back and you can go into divergence again, but on a much more specific topic. And somehow this cycle of divergence, convergence, divergence, convergence seems to be, how we do these workshops, and it seems to work really well. And it's actually, I think, how we do a lot of our private thinking too, without maybe being so aware of it. So I thought that was kind of an interesting principle. And okay, I hope this next slide is there. Oh, there's even that slide. Okay, fun and exciting. You never know what's going to be up. And okay, so that slide was gone. That's too bad. So thinking about this, and then taking online courses. And I'm talking traditional kind of university online courses. And this is a course that took this term that was primarily structured around a discussion forum, a threaded discussion forum. And to me, what would characterize the interaction we had there was not, the picture came. Maybe that was someone gluing it in, but that's nice. So you see a kind of, this classic threaded structure. And basically, this wasn't divergence-convergence. Rather, it was all divergence, or you could say stimulus-response. Because what would tend to happen is that you would start, and there would be one forum for each week, and you would start with a teacher providing some stimulus. And it might be some articles that you had to read, or it might even be a recording that she would generate, right? There would be some new ideas that she kind of introduces into the space. And then because we know that we have to participate because there's participation marks and we want to look good for the teacher, everyone tries to come up with something to answer. And so they choose some personal anecdotes often. These are many people who have been teachers for many years. So they'll say, oh, that reminds me of the time I was with my class, or reminds me of this article I read yesterday. So it's basically this free association whatever you can say that kind of has anything at all to do with this topic is fair game. And of course, that only lasts so long, and it dies out, right? And then there's some new stimulus introduced, and you can kind of draw this little graph, which you see on the screen here, and it just continues like that for 12 weeks, and then you're done. That was your course. And of course, you've been exposed to some ideas, for hopefully, and you've had a chance to hear a little bit of your co-students' ideas, but, you know, is this really all that we could do? Especially thinking back at some of those ways that we actually do real deep thinking in. So I had a very different experience with a very different platform. Okay, so this is kind of the traditional, yeah, exactly, their whole graduate programs like this. This is very true. Now, this is Knowledge Forum. It's a fairly old software created by Marlene Scardamelli and Carl Berater at OISE. It's been used a lot around the world, particularly in primary schools and secondary schools for science education. It's not open source or available online, and a lot of people haven't actually seen it. So I did a little screencast of how it works, and I put that up. I'll put the link to my blog, but I took a few screenshots here just to go through it much more quickly. So basically, it starts out, you know, it's a graphical interface, so it's not threaded. You can create these nodes, and here I'm just pretending to be a primary school student, which I might not be too convincing, but, you know, so you have this, you can write what's your problem, you write something, and they have this scaffold here on the left, and it's technologically very simple. You click one of these buttons, and it just takes that text and inserts it into the main text field. So there's nothing too fancy going on, but it's kind of more of a little nudge for you to think about, you know, to be metacognitively aware, to think about what are you saying, what kind of a statement are you saying, what kind of a cognitive role are you taking in this discussion. So, and it's proven very useful with, you know, training especially young students to be more aware of the kind of discourse that they're having. So you'll write a note, someone else might build on that note, and they, you know, could say, well, I disagree, or here's some new information that we have, or so on. And you can organize these, so you see these connections come up here. You can organize them any way you want, and you can even add background graphics and so on. So, you know, you can kind of customize your space collaboratively. Anyone who's participating can do this. So we use this environment for a graduate course, and we started a little bit similar to the previous course. We got a lot of stimulus, so we wouldn't have to do that. You know, some of the primary school classes just start with a blank screen, and they say, what do you want to know? But in our case, you know, there was a fair amount of scaffolding, and we started with the... Yeah, so the program, if you go into a post and you read it and you kind of click reply or what's called build on, it'll create that connection. But you can't actually create connections. You know, you can't just put in a post and then create connections afterwards. So it works a little bit different from let's say, a mind mapping software, a concept mapping software. So this is actually a draft of a book that the professor was writing. So she pre-populated these views. This is the first week's view, and kind of chunked up the book into small pieces and had us read it and, you know, reply. So far, very similar. You know, providing a lot of stimulus, and we were responding. We got into some really interesting discussions. It looks quite messy here, but if you've been following along, you kind of know what the different threads are. And you're able to, I mean, the nice thing here is that you're able to keep a bunch of different threads going at the same time, and you're not so tied down into the chronology of, you know, a discussion forum that kind of inexorably just marches on. But still, it's at the stimulus response phase, right? But what's really nice about this is that after a while, you know, we had maybe gone for 4 or 5 weeks, and we'd read through the whole book, and we generated a huge amount of ideas, huge amount of notes, and we said, okay, well, we still have half the course left, so let's step back. You know, anyone can create a new view in this environment, even the students. So we created a bunch of new views of the things that we thought had been really interesting, the things that have kind of come up during the discussion. And it wasn't planned at all from the outset. And so, for example, I was really interested in higher education. Other people were interested in creativity, 21st century skills, and so on. And so they created these views, and then they went around and they collected the notes that they wanted to take with them. So you can take notes and you can copy them, you can move them around. And to me, that's a really important point, because the ideas aren't kind of caught just where they start out, right? In the traditional discussion forum, when you post something somewhere, I mean, of course, the idea is, you know, the ideas can't be tied down, but the actual representation of the idea is stuck at that particular, you know, as an answer to that particular point at that particular time. Whereas here, you can really move them around as your understanding of where they fit in emerges. So, you know, we could have, here's one about adult education, I think, and open education. I'm writing a bunch of stuff about blogs and all that stuff. So I was able to bring all that in there. And when you then, you know, this is post from 5 or 6 weeks, and you bring them together, and you suddenly start seeing connections that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. And you start to see, okay, what are the pitfalls? What are the things that we're still wondering about? And how can we continue to do deeper knowledge building around this topic? Towards the end of the class, the teacher also had us do personal portfolios. So again, we went out, we said, okay, what is, you know, what are the key issues that I've personally been engaging with? How have I made contributions? And we constructed individual views that were used for assessment. But it's also something, it's kind of a nice takeaway, you know, and it's the kind of thing that you could invite someone in and say, well, you know, this is what we've been doing for the last 12 weeks, and here it is in a nice presentation. So instead of stimulus and response, in this case, you had this cycle of divergence and convergence, where you start by putting out a bunch of ideas, just kind of brainstorming, responding to stimulus, but then you go in and you start working on that knowledge, and you start moving it around, you start seeing themes, and you start going deeper into some of the things that were most interesting, and you create this representation, whether it's the representation of here's what we know about knowledge building in higher education, or if it's here's my personal portfolio, and that's something you could, you know, take with you that you could show to other people. So that has a value, because coming into class with 560 posts, and I mean, I even faced that to a certain extent with LAC 11. I was very interested that I didn't have time to get really involved with that class. As it was ongoing, I really want to go back there now and kind of, you know, look at what they came up with. But apart from some people who maybe took upon themselves to really synthesize the work of the class, I mean, a lot of it is you'd have to just kind of wade through a huge amount of information. So as I said, ideas are not fixed in one spot, right? So and it affords this emergent understanding of categories and connections, which I think is really important. And you have this shared up-to-date representation of the state of the knowledge of the group. And one of the things that they do with the knowledge forum when they use it in classrooms is that, you know, it's traditionally not used for fully online courses, although it can be done. And typically it's used for a class that meets every day physically. And so what they do is that they both work on this forum, and they create this shared representation. And they'll sit in the classroom, they'll have a projector, and they'll show these views on the big screen, and they'll be talking about it. And they'll be discussing, you know, because they have this shared thing that they're all referring to. And I was thinking, you know, it'd be interesting if you, for example, had during one of these Illuminate talks in this course, if you had such a similar kind of a graphical representation of this is where we got to this week, these are the key ideas, these are the key points that came up or things we wonder about, and we could refer back to that as we're having this discussion. It could be interesting how that changes maybe the way that we use this synchronous time as well. And, you know, this wouldn't have to be done graphically, actually. This is the same environment that I showed you in the very beginning that had these threaded discussions. It's made by someone else at OAZ. But he's experimenting with having this split view where you have these nodes on the left side, and then you have a Etherpad on the right side. And so you could kind of be reading these nodes during week one, and at the same time updating this shared representation of, you know, what's our current state of knowledge, what are the key questions that we're still struggling with. And what I suggested to him is that if he could maybe have tagging, then after 4 or 5 weeks, you could go back and see which topics you really wanted to bring to the fore, and you could tag those posts that had those topics, and they would automatically create like a saved search for all tags. So you'd go in there, see all the messages that you tagged, and you'd get a new Etherpad that was empty, and so you could go and start doing some synthesis of the post that had that topic. So there's ways of doing something like this without the kind of graphical spatial interface as well. And what I was just talking about, you know, one of the things that come up a lot is this difference or kind of dynamic between artifact and discourse. And I mean, it's not black and white at all, because they kind of overlap, but you know, there are some differences between them. And I think, you know, I think discussion forum versus a wiki is a nice metaphor to say that a discussion forum is a conversation. It kind of flows inexorably forwards, right? It's each post is very contextually bound to the previous post at that specific time, the previous post that it replies to, and they're not that interesting to go back to unless you really would just want to see how it developed. Whereas an artifact is something that probably is a little bit more independent of a specific context or time, and it's something that's more integrative. So you don't just, you know, add to the end of it, but you change it, and whenever you look at the you kind of see the latest update, the latest version that represents ideally the community's view of the knowledge, right? And so a Wikipedia page versus its talk page could be a good example as well. So I wrote here as cumulative versus integrative, time-based versus topic-based, maybe high context versus low context, and I've seen some researchers also talk about dialogue versus monologue. And actually didn't say that the discourse is a dialogue versus the artifact. And by monologue, they don't mean something negative or that it's only one person talking, but it's something where you put a lot more effort into creating a representation that you then kind of present maybe to others. And it's just a different way of interacting. So I think both of these are really useful, and it's useful to think about how different either pedagogies, learning environments kind of let us interact with those two and how they can interact with each other. So for example, so Dan Sethers, I've been very inspired by a lot of his articles, and in a very early article he talked about, you know, letting people have discourse around artifacts. And so he created this, and this is like 15 years ago or something, so it's quite new at the time perhaps, this environment where you kind of have a split screen and everyone kind of sees which artifact they're looking at, and they're able to then talk about that artifact. So, you know, whether that's a drawing or a website that people, you know, I mean, nowadays we have Google Site Wiki, I mean, we have Digo, we have everything. At that time, I guess that was quite new. But one of the things that he talks quite a bit about with this funny name, DX, is the idea of pointing to stuff, basically, you know, and that's what the students in Aspartam Alias class do when they meet, is that they have this big visual representation up on the screen, and they'll go and say, look at this node over here. What do you think? Should it be connected to this other node, right? And that's something especially connected to a graphical. I mean, even if you had a lot of text nodes, it might be easier to say this one, but especially when you're talking about a graphical interface, you know, being able to point is really important. And so there's been a bunch of research about, both from collaborative learning and even collaborative work, how do you let people work on artifacts over online, right? How do they point to stuff? And so this environment that was developed at Drexel University called Math Forum is pretty cool. They have this, so it's a kind of a shared whiteboard where people work together on solving math problems. And they have this chat going here, a text chat you see on the right. And they're actually able to, for each message they're writing, to point to something on the screen. And there's a line there that's kind of connected to your message. So if you go back in time and click on that message, that line, so if you say, I think we should delete this, anyone who then clicks on your message will know exactly what you want to delete. And this works like Etherpad in that you can kind of take a slider and just go back all the way in time. So it's actually a really neat little thing. Here you see a little bit more the different kind of design choices that they made here. And the slide is gone. But they also had the same thing where you could kind of work on a document together, and you could select a few paragraphs and then have an arrow that said, I think we should delete this. And then, you know, when you go back in time and click on that chat message, then the text would be highlighted. So pretty neat way of kind of interacting between those two. Now, Sethers has written a lot about the design of kind of collaborative learning environments. And two concepts that he uses a lot, which I think are very productive, is this idea of salience and constraints. And basically the idea is, I think there's a slide that really shows it well. So this is from his article as well. You know, text, if you look at pure text, basically nothing is privileged over anything else. You know, you look at it and it's just text. And then you have to read it and you can, you know, judge through the tone and the word choice and stuff like that, that, you know, the person might be more interested in certain things, but just looking at the text on that, there's nothing really that stands out. Whereas you can create these different visualizations, so you could have, you know, a concept map where you have to actually label every connection between one message to another, and by forcing you to label by and compendium that or Cohere that Open University did, they do that. And so it's kind of annoying, but it also forces you constantly to think, well, what is this actually? Like, what am I doing? And there's some other examples here. And one of the interesting things is they use spreadsheets, and they showed that you know, people really want to fill out all the squares. So if there were some squares that were, so for example, they had this, you know, a row for thesis and maybe a row for evidence and so on, and people really want to fill those out, even though they weren't told to do so. And so suddenly you have these kids sitting around the computer and they're saying, well, you know, what's the evidence for this? And we'll, how does this, you know, so the point is that the design of the tool shapes the way that they collaborate, and it shapes the work that they do together. And you see here another example, right? You have a threaded discussion. You have a graph where you show these explicit relationships, and you have this containment. So different ways of representing knowledge, really. And so Sethers actually did a bunch of very empirical studies where he had kids come into his lab, sitting against each other, could only use the computer to collaborate, and were given typically, you know, each person had half the clues to solve some mystery. And they used different kinds of environments to collaborate, whether it was just, you know, kind of Google Docs or a spreadsheet or some kind of a graphical system, and whether it's a graphical system with a chat or only a graphical system. And did this a bunch of times, and it was able to get some really interesting evidence in terms of the final product that they then handed in, and also bringing them back a week later, how much of the stuff that they were learning had they actually recalled. So some really interesting research there. And here you see an example of the knowledge map that, you know, really makes, you know, compare this to just a long written paragraph, it takes some aspects of the organizational knowledge and makes it very salient, and it constrains other aspects. And that's not to say it's better than text, but it's a different, you interact with it in a different way, and I think that's really useful to be able to analyze how we might, you know, design helpful learning tools and how we might be able to analyze what their impact is. So, you know, obviously we're interested in both these kind of MOOCs and even just networked learning in general, you know, whether it's blogs or Twitter or where we kind of all live. And I gave a talk a year ago at the conference organized by Scartamalia, because I kind of feel like these are you know, the open education people and the learning scientists need to talk more. You know, Scartamalia has a lot of great ideas and lots of interesting theories and technology, and a lot of other people do as well, and they don't know much about the open education space, and they don't, you know, maybe know that that's something they should be interested in. And on the other hand, we don't typically, a lot of open education people don't typically know much about really great research that's been going on for 10, 15 years, but, you know, it all happens in labs, it's all published in obscure journals, and we might not really realize that that's something that could be useful to improve what we're trying to achieve. So anyway, I gave a talk there with Sandy McAuley, who works with Dave Cormier, and we were trying to push them and say, you know, you have this thing, it's pretty cool, but it's a closed garden. It doesn't talk to anything. It's not very exciting. So we came up with two kind of small scenarios for how this could be integrated into the broader Web 2.0. And one way would be to say, okay, we still use this knowledge forum as kind of organizational principle, but it needs to be much more open, both, you know, taking stuff in and sending stuff out. So I should be able to email things, I should be able to, you know, have my tweets injected into it and Google Docs and Facebook and, you know, kind of go and harvest all the cool stuff and put it into Knowledge Forum and then do really like deep knowledge building around it. And then, of course, the stuff that once I've done that process, it should be able to come out in RSS feeds and, you know, wikis and export in all kinds of ways. So that's kind of one possibility. And the other possibility is to say, well, you know, maybe there is no such thing as Knowledge Forum. That's this little room or this little environment that we go into with our knowledge. And maybe we could create more of this overlay of the web. And, you know, things like Diego is a great example. And at the University of Washington, I think it is, they have this harvesting gradebook, which is also, you know, instead of having all the students go to your LMS and submit their stuff, you can just have them post it on their blogs. And this gradebook travels with you as you go to their blogs and grade the assignments right there. So could we think of some kind of a browser overlay or a plugin or something that kind of, while you're engaging with all these different platforms, help you make these connections maybe more explicit and share those connections with others than you've been able to today? So I've got a few Chinese slides here. I just thought it was fun. This is from a talk I gave like a year ago. But I was also thinking about, you know, as I was saying, that the broader blogosphere, this is kind of my representation of the edu blogosphere, although I didn't make this graphic. And I was talking about how, you know, it's not like we don't do knowledge building or convergence or, you know, deep reflection and learning. I would never say that. However, it's kind of on a different level. It's so I came up with this concept of macro and micro levels of collaboration. And, you know, micro level of collaboration would be me sitting next to a guy or sitting online with someone and working on an article, really trying to hash some ideas out, you know, going back and forth very intensely. And macro collaboration would be more, you know, the kind of thing where you read a lot. You might be keeping a lot of these different knowledge representations yourself. You're taking notes, you're maybe drawing mind maps as you're reading and as you're processing all this stuff on the internet to make sense of it yourself. And then you step back and you really think deeply about it, and maybe you write this blog post that's really integrating a lot of these ideas, right? And you put it out there, and someone else reads this, and they read a bunch of other stuff, and they put something out there. And so there is definitely, you know, knowledge building and deep thinking happening, but it's you know, the point of interaction between different people is at a larger granularity, so to say. So in this presentation, I was talking about how, you know, the EduBlogger sphere kind of has these people who play different, take different epistemic roles, and then, you know, Stephen Downs is one of the kind of spokes to just bring together a lot of material, kind of synthesizes it. And that's the reason I brought it up is because I didn't see anyone doing that in the Chinese environment, and it's something that certainly would make it a lot easier for me to be able to engage actively with what's going on there. So, you know, this idea of macro versus micro collaboration. And again, when I'm saying monologue, I don't mean that we're talking past each other or anything, but it's more at what level do we, you know, present things to each other, and how much of the thinking, deep thinking that we do, do we do individually before we put something out there that's more polished, that's more, you know, stands by itself. And academia is kind of the extreme case of this. You know, where you obviously have this deep, have this deep collaboration over, you know, decades of people engaging with each other's ideas. But every time, so, you know, you basically do it very lonely, unless you count maybe your lab colleagues. But you read all these articles, you take all these notes, you think about it, and then in a few years you publish this article. And then, so there are different timescales and different levels of interaction there. And you know, there's the idea that maybe different visualizations can help us, you know, automatize some of this work when the information, the amounts of information become so large, right? Whether it's kind of social network visualizations or latent semantic analysis or citation analysis or all kinds of. This is an interesting visualization that Chris Teplos did. He was actually using Knowledge Forum, and he used latent semantic analysis to show clusters of ideas, and then he generated these word clouds for each cluster so that you can kind of quickly see what they were discussing and so on. So, you know, I don't really have a conclusion. I've just thrown a bunch of ideas at you, but I guess part of the conclusion is that there is a lot of really interesting thinking about this in a bunch of academic fields, and you know, learning sciences is one of them, I'm sure, information science and cognitive psychology and a bunch of others. I think it's really interesting for us to maybe, and I'm sure some people in this course do, but to engage more with those ideas and think about how they might apply to what we're doing. And also, you know, because I think that the environment that we operate in, whether it's P2PU or MOOCs or whatever, could be really fertile grounds for exploration and research by a lot of those scientists as well. So that's also why I'm trying to kind of make them aware of the fact that there are all these people out there who are really excited to try out new technology, not like when you go to the school board in Toronto and you fight for years to be able to do anything. So, you know, I'd love to see more collaboration happening there. And basically, you know, if you want to talk more about this, we're actually organizing a course at P2PU, which is going to be called Introduction to the Field of Computer-Supported Collaborative Learning. It'll start in a few weeks, and I'm co-organizing it with a friend of mine. Here's our tentative schedule. We're still working on some of the readings and stuff like that. You see Daniel Sutters there, who did a lot of this work with graphics. He's going to be well featured. And it's going to be an interesting experiment because we're going to, you know, I still believe that having a core group of people who are committed to supporting each other socially, to reading each other's work, and, you know, to develop kind of a close rapport with each other, that's something really valuable. But at the same time, obviously having, you know, access to a much, much larger and probably more heterogeneous group, which can bring in a much larger range of ideas and so on. And also a lot of people who just don't have the time to commit to something, you know, that serious, you don't want to exclude them. So what we're going to try to do is to have a core group of people who kind of really commit to reading the articles every week and participating in the chats and, you know, supporting others. But everything they do will be, of course, public because that's how P2P operates. and to really try to foster kind of a peripheral network, call it a MOOC if you want, of people who are engaging any way they want, who are self-organizing, reading the materials, maybe blogging or interacting in other ways, using hashtags, and we'll try to pick up as much of stuff as possible of those kind of more peripheral contributions and try to highlight them. So to me, it'll be a big experiment. I really don't know where it's going to go, but I think it'll be really exciting, and I would invite any of you who are interested to check it out and maybe participate in some form. So that's really what I had, and thanks for your patience, and I'd love to hear some of your feedback and ideas.
Well, thanks for that. I'm just going to throw in a question to you that Chris just posted in the discussion area, which is, Stephen wrote about the anxiety of learning. Is part of this anxiety what turns many newbie MOOCers off? The overwhelming amount of information, would the tools that you've spoken of be of help?
I think they could be. So the tools that I talked about, a lot of them are really more focused on smaller groups. So there hasn't been that much work yet at kind of these massive groups. Although I think we could learn probably from experiments with online discourse and especially kind of e-governance where they're trying to involve thousands of people in UN debates and all that. IBM has some tools. Not sure if they're very successful yet, but I think there's some good thinking behind them. And certainly, if you come into a MOOC and you feel like maybe there are some representations of the key ideas, there are some links to the key readings and stuff, or if you go back and look at a course that was finished and you see that they kind of cleaned up after themselves and compiled some of the key stuff that maybe the questions that they did answer and maybe the questions that they didn't manage to answer and that they would really encourage a future group to grapple with, that could probably, and some of this could be done today, as I said before, and is being done today by individuals, right? It's not like this is something that doesn't exist, but thinking about whether there are tools which could support this.
Well, I think that's a little bit of a challenge that we don't quite have a clear sense on yet. Is, on the one hand, you made the statement that the P2PU model, you value sort of this core cluster of participants who've committed to, not sure, lack of a better word, a social contract or a learning contract where they're going to stay with the course, engage with each other, share each other, and support each other. We've been less focused on the open courses that we've run in that particular model. Our view has, to some degree, been if it's an interesting topic that resonates with people, they'll participate based on their own sense of interest. And to a degree, that might reflect some of the lack of interest that we have in experimenting with traditional schooling models and open courses. So, I think there's some area of research there that's certainly worth exploring, because on the one hand, if you go right back to CCK 08-09 and now CCK 11, we've had some names that keep popping up year in and year out, people that come back for more pain, people that perhaps just want to be involved at some level, people who come back to play more of a mentor role, offering support or guidance to others, as well as publications and those kinds of things that have come out of the course model. So there is a sense, I guess, in which the lack of structure and lack of focused expectations on the part of an open course enables people to, for lack of a better word, write themselves into the course, express their own interest without necessarily having the sense of obligation that they have to participate at a constant level from week 1 through to week 12 or however long the course goes. So I'd be interested in hearing a little bit more, from your perspective, what is lost and what is gained when you try and appeal with a core or try and develop a core component of contributors, because obviously there's some negotiation and there's some expectation. And so the question obvious is, you gain a bit in terms of having their involvement throughout the course, but I guess I'm curious also to see what does the P2PU model also lose if you start to increase the social structure?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I posted two links there. The last link is a talk, I think you've seen it, where I began kind of struggling with this concept of groups and networks And I made a joke on Twitter earlier. This last month, I think Iradle has this special topic on connectivism, and the Canadian Journal of Learning Technology has a special topic on knowledge building. So it's kind of like these two great Canadian learning theories, and one is focused on groups and one is focused on networks, and they both are tremendously powerful and interesting. And yet I feel like they can learn from each other, and that's what I'm grappling with. I think P2P is a bit different from, traditional classrooms in that everything is open. So in a way, there's nothing that really stops people from self-organizing around the MOOC. I mean, they'll find the syllabus that's been carefully put together, hopefully. Every single resource it's linked to are openly available, and all the interactions between learners will be available. So if you wanted to just sit in, listen in on all the conversation, you can certainly do that, and we encourage that. And if you wanted to respond or react, or, you can do that on your own blog or on other platforms. And what we haven't been good at is try to pull some of that back into the core course. And that's what I would like to experiment with, and maybe tell people like more explicitly that we encourage that. But so I think, we do kind of enable both ways. Now, the one thing I kind of worry about with the MOOCs is the kind of learners that are able to thrive. And I do wonder if there is a certain kind of small elite, who can thrive in such an open environment. And maybe we should try to increase that radically so that everyone can thrive. But I think there's something for maybe new learners, for people who are not so confident, who are not so used to kind of putting themselves out there for the whole world. To have this group of people that, when you write a blog post, that 15 people are going to read it. And, many times when I was writing blog posts a few years ago, I didn't know if anyone would read it, right? And that's a very lonely feeling. So I think that's, for example, that's definitely one of the things that groups can be good for. And then, the greater sense of maybe coherency or the shared cognition aspect of we're all trying to solve this one thing, we're all kind of know where we're coming from, can be really powerful, but it can also be really stifling, because what if the thing that they want to find out isn't the thing that you want to find out? And in that sense, I mean, I certainly find a lot of the courses I've been taking in university that have all these collaborative aspects built in very annoying, because I have to spend all this time working with people who might not be that interested in the stuff I'm doing, and I would much rather be free to just work with whoever I want online, which is what I do with open education. So, there's I think it's an interesting debate for sure.
And there's a lot of opportunity for exploring a bit more what's evident in each particular system and approach, and what one approach offers that another one perhaps doesn't. And again, this has a lot to do with just personal interest, or in some cases, research interest. If you're part of your intention is to gain a better sense of the role of these social groups for supporting and sustaining learning, obviously there are certain models that'll be more desirable than others. I think it's one of the things we've grappled with as well with open courses is, to what degree, if we measure open courses by their traditional metrics, one individual's quality of learning and the outcome of that learning, then obviously if that's what we value, we have to start to model MOOCs on more traditional course structures. On the other hand, one of the things I think we've seen open courses is doing for us and for others is, first of all, it's a learning experience for us as facilitators. We don't approach a MOOC, at least I don't approach a MOOC with the perspective that I'm going to teach everyone stuff. I start more from the perspective of I'm going to engage in conversations and share some of my views and opinions. And what happened as a byproduct, the diffusion of discussion and knowledge within a MOOC is very difficult to assess. For example, we're 3 years after the 2008 offering, and I'm still seeing publications and articles or book chapters and references come out of CCK08 and CCK09. So there's a sense in which the interaction, the diffusion of knowledge is different in those spaces because of the different ways that people choose to engage with it. By the same account, I'm also a firm believer that if you want to influence others or interact with others, it's very important that you create artifacts that reflect your understanding at a particular point. It's not so much that you have to accurately reflect the knowledge in a discipline at that stage, it's that you have to reflect your developing understanding of knowledge in a discipline, because, you know, when you share those resources, that progressively starts to trigger other people who are at a similar point to, you know, form connections and begin to engage. So there's a real sense in which we're trying to appeal to the networked view of knowledge and understanding, and less, well, I shouldn't say less so, but, you know, it's not a specific focus that we want a core group to achieve a particular outcome. It's instead we want to have interesting conversations that may take a period of time to resonate through a knowledge system. And in the future, even though someone can take a MOOC now and come back 5 years down the road and say, you know, wow, that really was a significant part of my learning experience, you know, those kinds of things we haven't figured out yet. But regardless, you've obviously touched on a few topics here that are well worth additional thinking and research. So what are your publication interests around some of the ideas you were sharing today?
Well, I'm in my first year of my PhD. I'm just finishing my first year. And, you know, this is a big part of my research interest, basically looking at open learning environments, P2PU, MOOCs, other informal learning, and, you know, looking at motivation, looking at how you can measure success, because even though it's hard, at P2PU we try to keep improving, and it's very hard to know if you're doing that if you can't measure, come up with some measures of success, right? Assessing student learning. There's a bunch of interesting questions, but this is certainly one I'm very interested in. Another thing, just briefly about the course model, and I've been thinking a lot about this as I've been trying to design this course that we will be organizing, you know, it's the whole motivation part, right? And I mean, to a certain extent, you can say that it's great with open learning that people can drop out when they want, because if they're not getting out of it what they wanted, then they should drop out, and it's a problem of universities that is not that easy to drop out. So you could certainly make that argument, but on the other hand, you know, I know myself that I kind of compare it to trying to lose weight. As you're trying to do something, I mean, you came there voluntarily. Nobody made you come to the MOOC or the P2PU course. You came there because you really wanted to learn. You really wanted to engage with some, you know, deep theories and stuff like that. And similarly, you might have decided that you want to lose weight or become more fit. But when, you know, push comes to shove, and you're sitting in front of this really difficult article that you're struggling with and your eyes are glazing over, you know, it's a lot easier to turn on Netflix or read some blogs, right? So it's actually a good thing to kind of push ourselves to struggle a little bit. You know, I certainly wouldn't want the only open courses that survive to be the ones that only view TED Talks and have fun, you know, conversations. It's good for us once in a while to struggle with something difficult. And so I'm thinking, you know, what are the things that can encourage people to do that? And there's a bunch of different ideas, but one of the things I think we didn't have at P2PU was kind of a clear sense of a course as a challenge that can be completed and that it's a bit meaningful to complete it. And so that's what I've been trying to build into our course, is that we have a number of challenges in the form of badges that people, if they want to, can kind of sign up for. And there's a clear sense of when you've completed the course, you've gone through the challenges, and it's ideally something that people could actually feel proud about and feel quite, you know. And what's fun too, talking about peer learning, I mean, this is a topic that I'm very far from an expert in. In fact, my motivation for organizing this course is that there is not such a course at the University of Toronto, and I would like to take it. So, you know, we'll make it. And me and my co-organizer, we're going to do all the same assignments as all the other students. We're going to be challenging the same badges, and we'll have to do that if we want to complete the course. So, you know, although we're doing a lot of the preparatory work, you know, kind of the scaffolding before the course starts, once the course starts, we're pure learners just like anyone else. And I think that's going to also be helpful in trying to reduce that, you know, gap between the teacher and the learner that kind of seems to creep up in most open courses as well.
All right, well, on that note, I think we're sort of at the end of our session here. I just want to drop this in here for those of you that would like to hear more of CN's ideas and concepts, feel free to drop into a session, a CIDR session he's doing in, I think it's, what, an hour, 2 hours from now? So feel free to drop in on that if you'd like. The information's available on that site. So thanks again for sharing your thoughts, your ideas, and some of your developing research on this. Certainly look forward to hearing more as your concepts and ideas develop. And I think the point that you made throughout the session, I think you made a few times, is that, you know, there needs to be a greater sense of connectedness between people who are perhaps, you know, in the open education or similar spaces with those who are taking a more academic slant, seeking to, you know, identify and extract certain patterns and use that as a premise for further research. There definitely needs to be greater connectedness between those disciplines of doing and theorizing and research. So, but if I could ask the participants in the room here just to join me in giving CN a quick round of applause for a great presentation, and I'll end the recording there.